I saw this image in Paris in 2019. This is outside of the Shakespeare bookstore. And right, if you follow the equation here, Shakespeare, early modern literature, 16th, 17th century literature, plus an environmental focus equals love and life. I totally agree with this, like in my bones, I agree with it, but there's a lot of nuance here and complexity and difficulty, and that's what we're gonna be talking about today. We're basically just gonna like unpack this, because I know a lot of you don't know about the environmental humanities. Some of you don't know too much about early modern literature. Some of you know a little bit of both. But I've organized this talk into four segments, really. I'm just gonna start with the basic tenets of environmental humanities. What are they, what do they do? I'm going to talk to you about early modern literature, give you some examples of literature talking about ecological issues. Then I'm going to give you sort of like a more scripted part of the presentation where I'll talk about something that I'm working on in my book. Okay, so anyone who works in the environmental humanities, if you're a sculptor, a painter, a musician, a historian, a writer, if you're a literature scholar like I am, there are about three things or so that kind of everyone sort of agrees on. It was actually kind of hard to boil this down. The first thing that everyone sort of shares in common is the idea that the human and the non-human, what we call nature and what we call culture, are not separate. So instead of talking about divides, so nature is like out there and we have to go out to it. It's about entanglement. Humans and non-humans are constantly entangled. We are entangled right now in the electricity and the fossil fuels that are powering this room, or what you had for lunch, or the air that you breathe, right? So enmeshment. Kind of along those lines, if you believe that everything is enmeshed and entangled together, it decenters the human from a privileged position or a position of superiority. So this does not mean that humans don't matter, right? This is not misanthropy. It's just saying that there are other perspectives out there in addition to the humans. Right? And then the last thing, I was just thinking of a good word for this, encouragement or catalysis. Like environmental humanities folks build coalitions. They reach out across disciplines. They work with others that might be in the humanities. So, a literature scholar working with someone in music, right? But it could also be reaching out to the sciences. So, I work on ice. I read a lot about early modern ice and early modern glaciers, but I'm also reading work by contemporary glaciologists. Right? So we're interested in building coalitions, and the idea here is not necessarily like, if you write the perfect poem, climate change is solved, right? No one really believes that. But we do believe that the humanities can be part of a broader kind of push, a tool, so to speak, that can redress real-world issues. Right? It's part of the mix. To help kind of flesh out some of these ideas, I really like this collection from 2021. It's co-edited by a good friend of mine, Jeffrey Jerome Cohen. So I really recommend picking this up if you can. It's very accessible. It's not very expensive. But in the first couple of pages, I really like how they lay out what the environmental humanities are up to. So the first thing, environmental humanists share neither a single method nor a determinative object of analysis. More than anything, what unites the environmental humanities is a sense of shared and open endeavor addressed toward the remediation of environmental harm and a powerful conviction that scholarship in the field must revisit its foundational assumptions and engage with a broad constituency. So it's not that like environmental humanists work on, say, green things only. And if you're not working on green things, then you're out of the club, or you're off doing something different. One of the strengths of environmental humanities is its flexibility and its versatility. You can work on ice, you can work on animals, you can work on any number of things. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment when I get to methodologies. But similar to what I was saying too, the remediation of environmental harm gets back to that idea of like coalition building. The second thing is a commitment to the world-making power of narrative, and especially a commitment to how stories mediate different registers of power and how narratives have historically managed the manifold vitality of the cultures, bodies, and objects that shaped and are shaped by them. If you boil down all those the different kind of professions that I was saying earlier, sculptor, musician, lit crit, we're telling stories. We're telling stories about the world. We're telling stories about what we want the world to be, what we want the world to look like, narrative. And then the third thing, perhaps what really defines the loose, still evolving EH communities as scholars is not their methods nor their analytical focus, but their gregariousness, their insistence that the practices of making and communicating ecological knowledge should be collective, should proceed in conversation with and across other disciplines, and should test the limits of disciplinary methods. The environmental humanities cannot be a solitary practice. And I just love this last line. Back to the kind of coalition building. But inherently collaborative. It's not a weakness that the environmental humanists have a wide net. It's a strength, right? It's a power, really. Okay, so I want to go back to my sort of distillation and then talk about this image really quick. This is in Delaware. This is the Bombay Hook Wildlife Preserve or Bird Sanctuary. It's pretty close to the Delaware coast. When I look at this image, I'm looking at the nuclear power plant in New Jersey, which supplies the power to my state, most of my state. I'm looking at the water. I'm thinking about the health of that water. Delaware, our motto is the first state, because we were the first to ratify the U.S. Constitution. huzzah. we've also been called the chemical state because of the DuPont Chemical Corporation. It's its headquarters in Delaware. And there's a toxic legacy that runs throughout the state. So I'm thinking about the health of these waters. Here I am on a road in a sanctuary taking a photo of a bird, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, this is my perspective of the environment. Well, what is the heron's perspective of the environment? I'm trying to think about how the heron is being and perceiving. I'm also wondering about the Lenape, the indigenous people of Delaware. Are their voices part of this picture? Why and why not? But at the core of this image, I just see enmeshment, right? Nature, culture, myself, the water, the mud, the plants, the roads, whatever this is that I'm now breathing into my body. You can't look at this image and say, okay, yeah, that's nature and that's culture. it's just enmeshed. And on this point, we used this image a couple years ago. My colleagues and I put together a symposium. We called it Watersheds for the Association of the Study of Literature and the Environment, or ASLI. And we use this image as sort of an entrance into the topic, the precarity of watersheds. Okay.
Let's talk about methodologies.
I could be up here for hours and hours and hours talking to you about the different like methodological tracks of the environmental humanities. Not gonna do that. Right? But I'm gonna give you seven of the biggies. Right? So this is not meant to be like representative or exhaustive of EH. And again, it was kind of hard to distill this down. Like when you think about it, you're like, what is animal studies all about? But I tried my best. Okay, so animal studies. Base of animal studies questions the definitions of the human, definition of the animal, and their distinctions. Favors the multi-species over speciesism. So speciesism is claiming that one species is more superior, deserves more attention than the other. Have you heard charismatic megafauna? That sense of like, okay, things with faces and that look cute get human attention more than say like a blobfish, right? Or like a bug. So that's an example of speciesism. Why are cats and dogs treated differently than cicadas and, an animal studies person would ask that question. Some of the things that they might talk about, abuse, like factory farms, domestication, biodiversity, and then what I've done in bold is I've kind of given you like my takeaway from each one of these methodologies. So what animal studies has really helped me think through is the idea of companionship. How human and non-human animals depend on one another. The next thing, environmental justice is another one. Someone working in environmental justice might ask how to define, protect, and expand the idea of rights. So why are rights, what are rights, and why are rights given to some and not to others? It often intersects with indigenous, urban, and black ecologies. Not always. I just want to make that point. Like these are sort of methodologies in their own right. But someone working in environmental justice might say, well, why is it that it's predominantly the poor and communities of color that bear the burden of environmental harm? Why? Things like environmental racism. So an environmental justice approach would talk about health, talk about law, talk about equity. But one of the things that EJ has helped me think through is just the idea of repair. How do we repair these relationships, these deeply troubling, injurious relationships? So repair, reparation, amends. Third one, ecofeminism, kind of explains itself, but it explores the relationships between women and the environment. It also can, more broadly, talk about gender and why certain spaces are gendered, and then why certain roles are gendered in those spaces. So an ecofeminist approach might pay very close attention to hypermasculinity, the masculine kind of like domination of the feminine environment. So it could touch on misogyny, patriarchy, reproductive rights. Almost all of my work on embodiment, the idea of corporeality, comes from ecofeminist work. So someone like Stacey Alimo, for instance, ecofeminists are very, very attuned to notions of embodiment. Stacey Alimo is famous for the idea of transcorporeality, which is how substances pass through and then between bodies. You might have, like Donna Haraway, Greta Garbo, people like that, working in ecofeminism. The next three, material eco-criticism, which is kind of my jam. Material eco-criticism will trace the activity of physical matter, water, ice, coal, sees humans and non-humans as storytellers. So if you subscribe to the idea of the human and the non-human as being enmeshed, and art coming out of that enmeshment, now you're starting to think about how, kind of like hydrographies that Sophie was mentioning earlier, it's the influence of the material world that then sponsors or creates or co-creates narrative. So someone working in ME will talk a lot about assemblages, that's a word you used earlier, networks, and the more than human. So human, coffee, electricity, whatever that is, I don't know what that is. So think of networks, and then think of the word agency. So how the non-human world impacts humans and non-humans, as in like an agent, right? What does water do? What is water's agency in specific instances? A material ecocritic will follow that path. The next one, queer and trans ecology. So disputes that natural sexuality and gender as hetero and cis, heterosexual and cisgendered, embraces non-normative affiliations and kinships, and some of the key terms will be like affect. So thinking about sense and sensuality, feeling, fluidity. And then I don't know. I use the word orientation, but I might change that more. Maybe more like attraction. So how bodies are sort of attracted to other bodies, or I guess yeah, sort of oriented or disoriented to other bodies. And then yeah, for me, they have really helped me think about desire. So desire not being between male and female, and that kind of like unidirection, but being much more. Multi-directional, multivalent. And then the last one, I kind of combined these, again, just for the sake of time and space, but post-colonial and political ecology. So someone working here would focus on encounters and sort of like cultural encounters between humans and humans and humans and non-humans. And then how hierarchies are formed from that. Usually with the colonizer on top, how borders are created and transgressed, the violence that comes from these encounters, and then also the exchanges that move between. They might interrogate policies of in and exclusion, and displacements. Emplacement is like settler colonialism. I'm going to come over to this place, I'm going to take your resources and I'm going to plant my colony here. Settler colonialism. I'm going to emplace us in this place, and usually that means I'm going to displace whoever was there before, or subjugate whoever was there before. So resourcism, this is sort of the belief in basically that places are just valuable only for their commodities, water, metal, wood, along those lines to extractivism, so mining, things like that, and then imperialism, issues of sovereignty, and then, yeah, lastly for me, POCO and political ecology really stress power and power relations. Who has power, who delegates that power, who wields that power, then I guess the kind of last thing I'd say about this too is that I would talk about empowerment as well, right? So it's not just like top down, like the oppressor and the oppressed, but post-colonial will also talk about power from the ground up. So how do power regimes get thwarted and changed or overthrown? So they also focus on empowering people that are feeling the effects of, let's just say, extractivism. Okay, so those are kind of like the big six. But here's the thing. There's always more. Et plus. vegan studies, food studies, eco-horror, you know, you might be sitting here and you might be thinking, I'm not really like a literature person. I'm not really into novels, I'm not really into long form. Game studies, probably my next project is gonna be on video games and water. Art media studies, actually thinking about like what media is made of, where our electricity comes from, how things are like stored in the cloud and the electricity that it takes to store things in the cloud, things like that. If you wanted to work on like manga, if you're like, okay, I really want to work on manga and like images of the mountains and manga, you can do it, right? There is something here for you, trust me. You can do it. And on that note, let me talk to you about the blue humanities. So the blue humanities, this is from Steve Mensah's introduction that just came out, also excellent. He puts it pretty simply, the blue humanities combine water with human ideas. So again, back to that idea of sort of like how water affects the human imagination, how poems and plays and sculptures and operas and things are produced from that combination. Again, interdisciplinary, it's gonna combine literary, historical, and critical modes. And then it crafts critical language that responds to strife while also seeking justice for humans and non-humans alike. Back to that idea of like addressing real world issues. This is also a picture from Delaware. This is the Atlantic coast. This is Lewis, Delaware. Lewis was founded by the Dutch in like the mid 17th century. And so the little Lewis Lighthouse. This is Cape Henlopen State Park. I really like this image because if you look at this, well, first of all, there are different shades of blue here, right? So the blue humanities is water in all different kinds of phases and forms. It's not just ocean, definitely can be ocean. It's also atmosphere, water vapor, where it kind of gets like lighter blue as you go up. It can be the water that's in the ground, right? That's like nurturing these plants. Actually, I did this on my first day here. I just walked down to the Musée de Confluence. I love how Confluence is Confluence, which literally it means flowing with. And so, yeah, I walked out to the point here. Just kind of like in the tribu, there's crossings between the different methodologies. You can't think of these methodologies as being separate from each other. That would be a mistake. So just like I said, that there isn't like one thing that environmental humanities people work on, like, okay, we work on green things and green things only, otherwise you're not an environmental humanist. It's the same thing here. You're probably pulling from different methodologies in your approach. So I don't know, if you were doing manga and mountains, I don't know, maybe you're pulling from ecofeminism. Maybe you're talking about the politics in that manga, right? So you have to see these things as sort of like coming together. An example of this, when I teach the Blue Humanities course at my university, let's say I'm teaching 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Did you get the Jules Verne's fans? Do you guys read Jules Verne? Is it like, okay. I love 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I think it's a real trip. So when I teach 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Blue Humanities, for sure, because we're talking about the sea, and we're talking about the Captain Nemo looking at the sea, or kind of lionizing the sea as this place of liberty and this place of freedom. But we're also talking about, well, I'll spend a lot of time talking about the post-colonial aspects of this, because Nemo is a colonized subject of India, and he's trying to free subjugated people. He's got a portrait of the American abolitionist John Brown, right, like in his study. And yet, he also kind of falls prey to the colonizing mode. Because he plants his flag in the South Pole. And we'll spend a lot of time talking about that tension. There's also that scene too where he just decimates the sperm whale population, right? Because he says they're ugly. That's speciesism, right? So, you know, in one day we could do Blue Humanities, animal studies, post-colonial studies together. I also have students who are really intrigued by the relationship between Aronnax and Nemo. It's a very like homoerotic relationship. Like Aronnax just like spends a lot of time talking about Nemo's body, and so I'll have my students say, "Okay, well, what is it about water and being in this kind of fluid space that is allowing them to express and kind of follow that desire?" Queer ecology. Okay, so that's the end of part one. Now let's go into the early modern section. So again, this is not meant to be exhaustive. I was just trying to think of just some of the books that I've been thinking about recently, but I also kind of wanted to give you a sense of like the flavors of early modern environmental humanities. Ecocritical Shakespeare, this came out in like 2011. And it was one of the first collections like devoted specifically to Shakespeare and ecology. But since 2010, 2011, there's been a flourishing. I mean, there are like series now on early modern ecologies, including one by Amsterdam University Press that did this one, this book a couple of years ago, on early modern French ecologies. Right? So yeah, if you kind of you can just kind of go around, go down the line here. We have books on weather. Books on oceans, books on spas, so let's say clothing, bugs, insects, and like just the animal, that's when we talked about Noah's Ark, sheep, oranges, and yeast, trees, just kind of a general collection, and then an anthology of early modern environmental texts, like primary texts. With nice little like introductions. So if you were working in the in early modern environmental humanities, what are some of the issues, early modern issues that you would research? I'm going to give you four examples because again I would be here forever. Four big ones. So the first one, this is kind of right up my alley, is the Little Ice Age, so the early modern climate. The Little Ice Age, have you heard of this term before? So the historical climatologists designate the years roughly between 1300 and 1850 as the Little Ice Age, because in Europe, particularly in Northern Europe, the temperature fell by about 2 degrees centigrade, right? Not all at once, and not like consistently throughout that period, but particularly in the late 16th century and most of the 17th century, it was very cold. It was like the coldest parts of the Little Ice Age were right around when Shakespeare and his contemporaries were writing. So as you would expect, if you come to my Hamlet talk on February 14th, you'll have an hour and a half of this, which will be great. But as you can expect, poets, playwrights, they wrote about it. Thomas Nash is one of one of Shakespeare's contemporaries. Wrote a lot of kind of pamphlet literature, but he wrote this pageant that would have been performed at court. basically, where the four seasons would kind of walk out, and then would kind of poeticize about the world. So summer would kind of come out and be like, da-da-da-da-da-da. And spring would come out, blah-blah-blah-blah. Winter would come out, da-da-da-da. Okay. So there's this one point of the song where they all sing together about summer's absence. Adieu, farewell, earth's bliss, this world uncertain is. And this is the name of the talk. Because they weren't sure if summer was coming back. It's very cold at this point in time, and I'll touch on this a little bit more when I get to my kind of the more like scripted part of the presentation. But yeah, they thought deeply about their climate and whether it was going to get warm again. They saw their world as being thrown into instability. How do we navigate this space? That's one thing. There's a lot of writing about disasters at this time too. This is a more famous one. I kind of cleaned up the image for you a little bit here, but this was the the Bristol Channel flood. Bristol's sort of like a little bit west of Wales. Any of you have been to Wales, Western UK? But as you can see, there was an awful flood. It killed a couple thousand people. It's animals are suffering, people are suffering. There's a baby being, I don't know, and who knows where that baby's going. People climbing trees. People crying out for help. Not quite sure what caused the flood. It might have been a storm. Some people are saying it might have been a tsunami. But in any case, this is an eyewitness account, John Stradley. He wrote a little poem about the event. He wrote, "Mortals pointlessly strive to restrict the outlaw waters with laws which are not bound by law." Right? Water doesn't know laws. Water doesn't follow human regulations. "No fixed rule applies in fluid matters. And quickly the driven waves swelled by with swollen blasts of wind. Neptune, there is no faith in your government. Boldly you protect the things that are yours, and by force you snatch those that belong to others." And so, yeah, this is a little poem. It's like from a letter that he sent to, I forget, one of his family members, but it's a super long title, and I clipped it for you, about the incredible flooding of the Severn, in which that seawall recently built at Aberthaw was overcome and wholly torn apart. So early moderns could look to the sky and look to temperature and look to climate and look to weather. Uncertain the world is. It could also be like literally at their doorsteps. How do we live in this destabilizing place of catastrophe? We built a seawall. Seawalls can't hold the water back. There's a problem with deforestation at this time too. So even by the time Shakespeare was around 1600, Shakespeare was writing plays like As You Like It, which are set in forests. England was running out of wood and was starting to turn to coal to heat itself. And so we get little ditties like this. So Michael Drayton wrote that it's a massive, massive poem. It's basically like a long geographical poem. He goes to each section of the island and just poeticizes the landscape. Polyolbion, which is basically like all of England, Albion, right? All of England. On the section on the Forest of Arden in Warwickshire, which is where Shakespeare is from, we get this section. This is actually the forest speaking. So, thus of her own self, the ancient forest of Arden spake. My many goodly sights, when I first came to show, here opened I the way to mine own overthrow. For when the world found out the fitness of my soil, the gripple wretch began immediately to spoil my tall and goodly woods, and did my grounds enclose, by which in little time my bounds I came to lose, but lose. So again, degradation, right? We can cover uncertainty of climate. We can cover the uncertainty of the world, the waters, and catastrophe. Now we're thinking about humans' degradation of the non-human landscape, and and an advocacy for the forest. Right? I think sometimes like anthropomorphism gets a bad rap. Making the non-human sort of appear human, but if you do it strategically, right? I mean, this is a pretty strong indictment of what was happening at the time, right? I mean, Michael Drayton isn't like, remember when the forest used to be there? Like, this stuff is being like cut down as he's writing. Okay, last one. On that note of coal, air pollution. So this is I love John Evelyn. He has this like very long diary, and he has some of the best stuff about the Little Ice Age and the frost fairs is from John Evelyn's diary. But he wrote this pamphlet called Fumi Fujium. Fuji Fumi was a great name for a band. Guys, I'm just gonna give that to you right now. Anyway, all right, so you run out of wood, you start burning coal, what is that gonna do? Well, it's gonna pollute the air. So, this is what Evelyn says, let it be considered what a fuliginous crust is yearly contracted and adheres the sides of our ordinary chimneys where this gross fuel is used. And then imagine, if there were a solid canopy over London, what a mass of soot would then stick to it, which now, as was said, comes down every night in the streets, on our houses, the waters, and is taken into our bodies. All right, so he's not just saying like, okay, look, this is gross stuff, it's out there, let's go inside, we're fine. He's like, it permeates everything. Every breath you take, you're grosser. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Sorry, Sting. But the air that you breathe, the more you breathe, the more coaly you become. So it's not a coincidence that he's talking about chimneys and he's talking about the throat. You're just becoming a chimney. And the reason why I like John Evelyn a lot is that, you know, as he goes on, he talks about how certain people are affected by this more than others. So particularly the people who, well, it kind of makes sense, like the people who were responsible for building the fires and for keeping the fires, which were usually women, were the most at risk. And he just calls that out. So early environmental justice pamphlet, right? Clean up the air, clean up our bodies, and then, by the way, you know, the people who are suffering the most are the people who are building these things for you. Okay. So, great. We talked about what you could research historically in the early modern period. I'm gonna try to unpack this in a little bit. We've talked about what you could talk about in the early modern period. But what about the now? So my work, if you ask me, what do? I would say, I borrow words, images, concepts from literature that's, 300, 400 years old, and I use it to address environmental issues right now. So some people, this is what's called presentism. So some people would look at that presentist approach and say, this is anachronistic. Early moderns did not think like we do, right? And to read what we're suffering from as what they're suffering from is a mistake. And I would push back against that. I think that it's more complicated than that. Just going back to back winter, I'm not gonna look at this and say, climate change. Early moderns would not have called it climate change, right? But they, as I said, they thought very, very seriously about how their climate was changing or not changing. So you can do both. You can do the historical part, right, and get into like the details of the history, and you can talk about the details of the issue at present. You can explore the tensions between the two. So you can look at the similarities and you can look at the differences. The example I'm going to give you in a little bit is a good example of that. I'm going to tell you about the North Wind. The way that they thought about the North Wind is a lot different than the way that we think about the North Wind, but that's useful to us. Right? Now, back to the, Okay. Luton.
Luton.
Yes. This is a pun by Michel Serres, the late French philosopher. Now, correct Serres if he's wrong. Luton is time and weather.
Yeah.
Okay. So, for me, well, I think weather is flux, inconstancy, turbulence. I think of the past, those images, concepts, and words that I was just telling you about, as having that turbulent potential, right? These things kind of erupt, explode into the present. And this is why I like how Jen Monroe and Rebecca LaRoche frame presentism. This is a great book, and it's a great series, too. But, you know, they just come right out and they say, they're like, look, like our approach, our ecofeminist approach, doesn't idealize the language of the past, but rather sees in the past a destabilizing potential in this unthinking world. Okay? So again, similarities and differences. These things should should shake us up, get us thinking differently. They shouldn't just neatly overlay and be like, oh yeah, just as we think, they think. No, there's not really like a lot of use to that. But explore the tension between the then and the now. If you took a class from me, I actually called this class Eco Shakespeare Now, because there's a famous I showed it to you earlier. There's a famous book series Shakespeare now. If you took a class from me, this is kind of the way that I would frame it. I just wanted to share this. This is actually the course description. I just wanted to share this with you to give you a better sense of what I mean by this kind of tension between the then and the now. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day is one of Shakespeare's most quoted lines. Lesser known, perhaps, although you know it now, is that he composed Sonnet 18 during a period of unseasonable cooling, known as the Little Ice Age. So the course examines the way Shakespeare's poems and plays respond to his dynamic, unsteady world. This world uncertain is. From animals, weather, and disease, and across forests, cities, and oceans, we will learn how his works reveal the complex relationships between humans and non-humans, demonstrate the entwinement of place in the imagination, no divides, manage visions of crisis catastrophe, and redefine the meanings of nature and the natural. And now here's the turn. But we will also ask difficult questions inspired by our current moment. How might turning to 16th and 17th century texts and performances provide us with methods for thinking about crises happening right now in the 21st? How can we better understand ecosystems and their enmeshed communities through Shakespeare's works? What and who is excluded from ecologies? Why? How does Shakespeare construct, negotiate, and challenge modes of inhabiting the globe's most fragile places? How can early modern art not only speak to the present, but help imagine and usher in more flourishing futures? That's the question that sort of propels my work, kind of fleshes out the idea of like, I'm using really old concepts to address contemporary issues. And then this is an image from Rupert Gold's production of The Tempest from 2006 with Patrick Stewart, which maybe some of you have heard about this. I was there, no big deal. In Stratford-upon-Avon. It was set in the Arctic. So what was interesting about this is that at the end of the play, when Prosper like breaks his staff, drowns his book, his cave explodes and catches on fire. And so you're sitting there in the audience and you're watching this basically like little ice cap melt, which then gets you thinking about, well, what does it mean for the great globe itself shall dissolve, right? And everything shall vanish into air, into thin air. I mean, it's an image of dissolution. It's an image of liquefaction and an image of melting. It's kind of what we think about when we think about the Arctic. Anyway, okay. So now, this is not too long, but this is more the scripted part of the talk, where I just, as Sophie said, I'm finishing this book on coal and in the early modern imagination, the Arctic. For my epilogue, I'm really thinking of this question. And I want to end the book by being like, okay, well, now that you've made it this far, what do we do with this material hundreds of years later? So this is what I'm working on right now. Maybe I'll stand here because I have to click it. Hold on. The gist of Othello. There's a moment at the end of Othello where... So Desdemona has died. Othello murders Desdemona, and everyone's trying to figure out what happened. And Emilia, who was Desdemona's maid, she starts thinking about, like, okay, I think I actually know what happened. I think Iago, my husband, is behind this. And this is the moment I want to focus on. This is the last act, last scene of Othello. So upon realizing her unintended involvement in Desdemona's death, Emilia's next lines burst forth. Twill out, I, peace? No, I will speak as liberal as the North. So editors usually gloss the North as the North Wind, and liberally as freely, or without constraint. including the additional connotation of insolently or licentiously. Iago stabs her shortly thereafter, and she dies. Othello's deep-seated patriarchal violence, right, demands immediate correction. Emilia, the windy wife, must be silenced by blows from her husband's hand. But Shakespeare's reference to the North, even more unfortunately for her, expands the phrase's negative meaning. So early modern meteorologists, or they probably would have been called like natural philosophers, believe that the north wind, named Boreas, came from the globe's frozen zone. So there, the two zones that capped off the world were the frozen zone. It was piercingly cold, cruelly fierce. At the time the play was performed, as you know, a colder climate had altered life. In Europe, a period called the Little Ice Age. So to some, the North scattered cold southwards, sending a particle-like substance to invade the vulnerable body and upset its delicate humoral balance, right? So cold stuff comes from the Arctic. It doesn't stay in the Arctic, comes down, sweeps down, and enters your body. Quick little primer on humoral theory, or humoral, I don't know how I called it that, humoral theory. Basically, like, the body was believed to be composed of four humors: yellow bile, black bile, phlegm, and blood. Each one of these humors was associated with a specific element, and a specific season, and we're basically a specific like emotion. Right? So the idea would be, if you walked out into the Rhone River, for instance, you are going to get cold and wet, the qualities of water. That's going to make you more phlegmy, more phlegmatic, as a kind of dull, as a response, right? And then to correct that, you might have to go someplace dry and hot, right? Get the blood moving. But the idea here is that, and I'm kind of like rushing through this, but the idea here is that the body is not this sort of like container that like walks through the environment, kind of shielded from the environment, and every once in a while things will get into it. It's all about permeation. You're around water, it's going to affect your mood, it's going to literally affect your body. You're around earth, it's going to affect your mood, it's going to affect your body. So you're constantly in flux. So a north wind, cold north wind, it's going to make you enter your body. It's going to do things to you physiologically. So physicians, poets, and playwrights shunned its sharpness and pointed out human and non-human populations it pervaded. In A Winter Dream from 1649, for instance, James Howell thought himself protected against the wind. And this is what he says. He says, though the cousin German of death or winter has so strongly seized thus upon the exterior parts of this poor tabernacle of flesh, my inward were never more active and fuller of employments than they were that night. And so he thinks that, you know, okay, the wind is beating against me, but I'm going to keep it at bay. And yet, he can't help but dream of northern and southern worlds at war. Out of the north, all ill comes forth. And that's a biblical verse, right? But again, the idea is that you're constantly on guard, right? Emilia is killed for her cold blood, windy. Ideas of the North in this performative case both gauge and maintain male authority over wintry women and their unruly protests. But inspired by Emilia's example, I'm going to speak a little bit more about the blustery line.
not only for what it tells us about relationship between gender, race, and northern environments, but for what it can tell us about Arctic relations today, and how we might address imperiled communities on the upper horizon. Speaking as the North could be a physiological action in addition to an elaborate metaphor, back to the humoral theory I was just telling you about. As scholars of the pre-modern passions have pointed out, environment and embodiment coalesced when inhaled air, like from the North, literally became one's breath. Breathe in this stuff, it's now you. Humans are little meteorological systems in recomposition. So as England further pursued a passage, a northwest passage to Asia in the early 17th century, its writers struggled to demonstrate the greatness of their northern nation to their continental counterparts. So while they were just southerly enough, right, because like Sweden and Norway, they're farther north, they're just southerly enough to avoid negative associations with the terrible North, they still worried about maintaining the English body's supposed integrity abroad. For far northern latitudes, as a result, accrued racial and racist overtones. If the tender traveler's body could be altered by entering, or by being entered by, cold environments, its whiteness was likely at stake. George Best accompanied Martin Frobisher on his journeys to what's now Nunavut, or kind of Baffin Island, and this is like the mid to late 1570s, and wrote a very long narrative about it. And this is a true discourse. But George Best, for example, could only explain the Inuit's darker skin on Baffin Island in terms of disease. So he says, this blackness proceedeth of some natural infection of the first inhabitants of that country. And so all the whole progeny of them descended are still polluted with the same blot of infection. So for Best, speaking as the North meant being infected by it, transforming one's skin color, blackness, their nationality, or like their country, and even the species in the process. He often refers to Inuit as seals, right? So a cold environment can even like turn you into a beast. Despite attempts to preserve and protect the porous body and its vanishing white hues, the North refused to remain distant. Strong winds carried cold as well as Inuit visitors to European shores. James Wallace cited Inuit kayakers in Orkney, this is in Scotland, two times, once in 1682 and once in 1684. And then others were forced to make the transatlantic journey. Liberal for some proved far from liberating. The first captives, a woman and a child from Labrador, were brought to the Netherlands in 1567. So kidnapped peoples of the North spoke out. I mean, they surely spoke out, only to be enlisted in Southern spectacles of the Indian. There's that line from The Tempest, De Stefano, people will pay a droid to see a dead Indian. Regardless of its association with shimmering ice fields and the sublime imagination, the Arctic was and has never been white. Investigating the fraught impingements that the North historically created helps us challenge spatial and racial segregations built upon logics of superiorly pure, unpolluted whiteness. Right? All right, so let's get back to the play. Stay here, actually. So I think there remains, this is the conclusion, I think there remains something powerful in the no that Amelia declares. Actually, let's go back. No, it lingers in the air. So might speaking her no resist the chronically racist, nationalist, male-centered ideologies at present that would claim the North for industrialized countries, causing ill to societies atop the melting world? the South leaves the North polluted with little risk of reprimand. And yet, it's significantly against the state of politics that environmentalist women of color liberally speak Amelia's no. And Sheila Wakleti has really influenced a lot of my work on Arctic and climate justice. So Inuk activist Sheila Wakleti's argument for the right to be cold incorporates the twill, Amelia's twill, into her advocacy for climate justice, translates an outspokenness into ecofeminist practice. So as she says, it's difficult for representatives from warm countries or the South, for them, to grasp the fact that ice is something that people depend on, not just for survival, but to thrive. Because as hard as it is for many people to understand, for us Inuit, ice matters, ice is life. In refusing to hold their peace, voices like Wakleti's hold up possibilities for brokering peace. Amelia, after all, demands justice. Troublingly, the play fails to deliver a judicious outcome even after the crimes are out. Right about here. The object poisons sight. Lodovico's like a, kind of a gentleman of Venice. This is the last speech of the play, actually. The object, the bodies, poison sight, let it be hid. But the Venetian state's response is a reminder that it always takes more than a single look to recognize, let alone redress, the world's poisons. Early modern authors spoke of the North as both a wind and a place. In one breath, they conveyed the precarity of Arctic interrelations that remain pressing to this day. Now, this is an image from Earth Day in Nunavut. For 2005. Returning to Polar Pass, this is my argument, returning to Polar Pass fosters an ongoing commitment in our classrooms and in our communities to a steadily warming present, in which speaking up for the North can also mean speaking as, for, and with its garrulous residents.